everyone. Martin Willis from the Antique Auction Podcast. A little different type of show today. I'm going to go ahead with a little bit of a monologue. I'm going to try to make it quick. We have some phone guests coming up, people that I knew back in the 1970s. First of all, I just want to tell you my father had an antique shop in Maine, in Kittery, Maine, as well as an auction business. And one day, many years ago, a couple came in around 1975, Floyd and Carolyn Edmonds. And we'll be speaking with Floyd later on. And they bought just about everything in my father's shop at the time. And that began a relationship that lasted for a number of years. So I drove a truck out to Colorado one time full of antiques that Floyd and Carolyn had bought. Really loved Colorado. Thought it was a beautiful place. And I was 20 years old and asked Floyd if he had a position available. And he said yes. So I basically sold everything I owned, which really wasn't all that much at the time, and headed out to Colorado. My sister had moved out nearby about a year earlier, so there was a place for me to go. On the way out there, a van passed by me with Colorado license plates, and there was a whole bunch of pressback chairs tied on the top of it. And later on, I pulled into a rest area, and to my surprise, there was a van sitting there. And I introduced myself to Greg Willett, and Greg Willett will be talking to us later on in the podcast. That was 1977. So I worked in a little town called Niwot, Colorado. It was a beautiful little town with Victorian houses converted into shops, antique shops. And right in the center of town was the shop I was working in and auction gallery. And Floyd and Carolyn Edmonds owned it, and it was a great experience at the time. And I have Floyd Edmonds on the phone right now. How you doing, Floyd?
Just fine.
Good.
Enjoying not working anymore.
Yeah, we worked hard for a lot of years.
You bet.
Yeah, and it was a great experience for me all those years ago back in the little town of Niwot in Colorado. And we were just talking a few minutes ago, and you said at one time you had made 22 trips back to Maine. Is that right?
Wow. That's right. We would leave on a Monday morning after the auction and drive pretty well straight through and be loaded up and started back home on Saturday.
That's amazing. Now, I remember my dad used to just go out there all the time and look for things for you constantly. So tell me what changed when you first started doing business with my father. And then let's talk about the first time you loaded your trailer up there and how it progressed from there as far as prices and everything.
I loaded that whole thing and had chairs tied all over the back of it for $3,200.
Wow.
And the last load that I ran out there, and I don't remember what year it was, I had over 40,000 and it was only 2/3 full.
Yeah.
That's how it changed.
It really did change. And then it kind of went where the prices just leveled between Colorado and the East Coast.
Yeah, it got to, well, I bought my clock collection, sold my clock collection back to your dad's auction, got more money there than I could here.
Really? Wow.
Yep.
It's funny how that, it was bound to happen, you know, I mean, just with all of it going out of state like that, you know?
Yeah, it was really, you probably remember, you used to meet buses and trucks and trailers, stuff tied all over them.
Yeah.
I mean, it was something else.
Yeah, and a migration of furniture right out of the East Coast.
Yeah, it really did. You know, I remember where it was at. You probably will. The guy had all of the round oak tables. Yeah. I mean, he had every clawfoot table. He wouldn't sell you one at all, and he retired. He got two guys out of Oregon and Washington, or California and Oregon, came out, and they bought all that, and he retired in Florida off of that. He had clawfoot tables out there that it must have been, I'm going to say, and I'm not exaggerating, he probably had 300 round oak tables with heads and claws like you never saw.
And he wasn't selling them?
No, he wouldn't sell one of them. He sold the whole lot.
He wanted to sell only the whole lot?
He wanted to sell every one of them. He wouldn't sell you one.
Wow, no, I don't recall this guy at all.
Yeah, your dad sent me up there, and I can't remember the...
Oh,
it was kind of
wait a minute. I think I know who you're talking about. He had things in houses, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, he stored things in houses.
Yeah, he did, but this thing here. But then another, but he had those, and we went there, and they, it was kind of a, it was a tourist town, and I don't remember. It was off of 95 somewhere. I don't remember. But the best one I got into, and I was trying to think of his name, was up at Wolfboro, Maine, or Wolfboro, New Hampshire.
Right.
And he was a teacher, and he had this camp up there. And kids came up in the summertime, and in the wintertime, he filled these recreation halls and stuff with furniture. Ed Lamb and I loaded up there at 2 o'clock in the morning. And, oh, it was cold, terrible cold.
Yeah, I guess.
And we loaded stuff, and I had a chance, and I kicked myself from straight up there. I had a chance to buy a 60-inch roll-top Stickley.
Really? A Stickley?
It needed some work, and I could have did it, but we were pretty well loaded, and he wanted $500 for that.
Well, you know, I don't even know if I've ever seen a Stickley roll-top desk.
It was there. It had the writing boards. You pulled the writing boards out,
yep,
on the back of the writing boards.
It was stamped?
Stickley.
Wow.
AG, not the Stickley company. It was made by him.
Wow. Boy.
I kicked myself, but that was really before, you know, it really got to going.
Mm-hmm.
Before his dad set me up at his auction one time. They had a little drop leaf table that was pretty rickety. Probably, I'm going to guess, up, probably might have been 30 inches, 32 inches, and it came up, and he turned around, and your dad held up two fingers. So I started that thing for $25, and it brought $2,000. He laughed about that, so it never ended. He knew it was going to bring that kind of money. I asked for $25, and the guy, and it brings $2,000.
I had to start somewhere. Now, was that a Stickley, too?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
The table, yeah.
Oh, I got it. Yeah.
It stuck all over there, and the guy that bought it bought Stickley, and he and I was up there when he paid, and he reached in his pocket, and he pulled out $2,100 bills.
Well, you know, it's funny. If Stickley has not really been that popular for, you know, it wasn't bringing any money back when in the 70s, in the early 70s, and it just started getting more and more popular, you know?
Yeah, it did. I got an estate out of up in Estes Park up here that had a couple of pieces of Stickley, and it looked just luggage stuff, and it sold higher than a kite.
Yeah, yeah. It's amazing, and it's still the really good Stickley is pretty hot, and you know, I mean, there were some celebrities that collected that made that actually give it more publicity, so
yeah,
it sold pretty well. So just to give the listener an idea of what was going on in prices, in 1977 I was in your shop, and this is not the highest thing in your shop, but I do remember selling a set of press-back chairs to someone for, if I remember right, it was around $4,000. Is that right?
We had some real rare ones, and I know the ones you're thinking about, and I can't tell you the price, but they're, and I don't remember, I think they were signed, and they came from the Philadelphia area, but that's, I can't tell you, they were high priced.
Yeah, yeah. And I just did a little calculation in today's money that would be between $11,000 and $12,000. So that's quite amazing. And, you know, a lot of people are talking about how soft, no pun intended, oak is these days. But there are still some retail. I was looking online. There's still some retailers that are doing fairly well, or at least they still have some of the old day prices. But do you remember what the highest price thing was you ever sold out of your shop?
I think I sold a rolled, double rolls, I mean, a roll top desk, an oak one that I've got someplace up around the Skowhegan area. And I think at that time it brought around $7,500.
Wow, $7,500. You know what? I was there when you sold that. I remember it had a tambour top. Right?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And it had a real good interior. I think it had something with the top and the lower level. I think there was something like 97 drawers in it.
Oh, that's right. I remember. And refinished.
Right.
So let's just go backtrack a little bit. What started your initial interest in the antiques in auctions?
I guess in the antique business part of it. My cousin down in Denver, you remember him, Ed?
Oh, yes.
He started in it in about 69, and we kind of got involved in it the early part of 70. And we bought a few things and went along, and I think probably we had two auctions before I ever opened the shop, and that was opened the shop in Longmont in about 1970.
Was it Longmont or Niwot?
Longmont. I started out for a couple of years in Longmont.
Oh, I see. And when I was in Niwot all those years ago, that was the whole area was surrounded by wheat fields, and you're probably going to tell me that's different today, right?
Yeah, that every field that you saw at that time, Marty, was corn fields and wheat fields and vegetables and stuff. Most all of that now is houses.
Hmm. Well, it's bound to happen. Now, do you think the reason for you were selling so many things back then and the auctions and everything, was there a boom at that time back then as well?
I think to a certain extent there was. About that time, IBM was really going strong, which was from Niwot, was only, you remember, a couple of miles.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then Storage Tech was 5 miles up the road. And it just generated a lot. And there were just people of that seemed to be of the age that they wanted things like that.
Mm-hmm. It was really a trend at that time, that's for sure. Have you kept up on what's happened with Oak since you retired in Victorian?
Yeah, the market is soft, and what's our area out here with so many homes and everything, and I guess we have to face it, the reproductions in the Oak furniture and the dark wooded furniture have become pretty good, and the young people that were younger people that work are only home from 7 at night till 7 in the morning, and they can walk by a good reproduction just as well as they can an antique.
Yeah, also, is the trend in Colorado also mid-century modern like it is in so many places too, or are they still doing the Victorian look?
No, you don't see. I would be right honest, if I was still in the auction business, I would hate to have a high-powered Victorian auction, because I just don't think it would fly out here anymore.
Right, right. When you had your auctions, was it like once a month or something like that? I'm trying to remember.
We had the big antique auction once a month. And then we worked the states in and special sales in between. I think I did probably between 20 and 30 major auctions a year.
Hmm. Yeah, I remember working all the time there. It was a very busy place. And did you come up with the thought of the Oak and the Victorian things, or was that just what was hot on the market when you started?
No, when I really started in the auction, we worked Iowa and eastern Nebraska, and I guess I was a mail carrier, and I got every 5 weeks, I got a long weekend from, I got Friday, Saturday, and Sunday off. We would leave on Thursday night, and we would work Iowa, and I'd get home Sunday night and go back to work on Monday. But and then those people that we saw back there after we started the auction, they all become consigners.
Oh, I remember there was a guy that came out with a big horse trailer from the Iowa, someplace like that, right? Is that?
I think you're talking of, I can't say. He ran a restaurant. He had a brother that he sent me to that had a restaurant in northern Massachusetts.
Oh, is that right? Huh.
Yeah. Yeah. He was an attorney, and I forget what his wife was, but he'd bring a horse trailer in full ever so often.
I remember that. Yeah. And I do remember you had other people coming in from the Midwest as well as bringing in things from back east, all the way back east.
Yeah, I had a line, we had consigners that sometimes we would let them come every other month. We got loaded up pretty heavy sometimes.
Oh, I remember those long days. Now, I remember you were also a collector, and you had the cream of the crop of Victorian and oak. And I know you had told my father a few years ago you had sold most of it. Now, do you still have part of that collection? And do another thing, and do people, old contacts, ever contact you with really nice things like they used to?
They did the first 2 years, Marty, and it was really hard after we retired in 98. And it was really hard, old customers, old buyers, mm-hmm. people that brought stuff, and it was really hard to say no. I guess it got easier as it went, but I just didn't have room for anything. No, we had people that did, but I just, you know, we had to say no.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know this is going way back, well, we're talking 30-some-odd years ago that I worked there, but I do remember there was some real characters. Can you talk, besides Ed Powell, do you remember what the characters that were around that place and that used to bring furniture in?
Oh, you know, a couple of things. I had an auction in Denver, and I won't say his last name, but remember, you will know who I'm talking about, Dave.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And he had bought a small estate and brought it in, and naturally, everybody always wants everything sold at once.
Mm-hmm.
And we had sold a few of his things, and he was bugging me to sell. And so I got a couple of the boys, and I said, go get a couple flat carts, put everything he's got on it, and bring it up here. And so they brought it up, and Dave was sitting in about the third or fourth row, and he's shaking his head, no, 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 I'm just going to sell every bit of it at once.
Oh, jeez.
So I cured that one.
Yeah, I remember him. He was a pain in the rear end.
He really was, but he was one of the best buyers that we had at the auction. If he wanted it, he bought it.
That's right. I remember he had like a grocery store in Denver or something.
He had one of the best stores. He sold stuff higher than anybody that I know in the business, retail business. He had a clientele that wouldn't quit.
Yeah, yeah. Well, if you if you started all over again today, what would you think about that? I mean, with the do you have any idea what the internet has done to the whole business?
I've been to a couple of auctions and watched it, and then I had a big clock collection, and I had a man sell it for me over the internet. I couldn't have got prices at an auction anywhere that he got over that. So I think it's a good thing. It wasn't there when I was there, but and probably if it had been, we would have used it.
Yeah, I'm sure it was. Well, there's a misconception. A lot of people think it's less work. It's totally the other way around. It's a lot more work today than it ever was before.
Oh, I can see that at the auctions. I can see where that would be. Oh, you've got to be on top of your game there, or you could get burnt bad on the internet.
Yeah, if you're buying, yes. And also, people demand more information than they ever did. You know, I remember, you know, when I worked for you, and we'd have these flyers, and my father just had flyers, and we'd sell things and maybe get a few requests for pictures or things like that. But today you got to have 4,000 pictures up on the internet to satisfy.
Yeah, I don't know what it was. You remember working for me. We stood behind. The reason we were really successful is I stood behind everything I sold, and if it wasn't like it was, you didn't own it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, I remember you had just, not too long before you sold the business, you had just built the gallery really nice. You had a theater style set up. Yeah, that was real nice. And I remember my dad and I came out to your first auction there, and tell me if you remember this. My father was moving a floor lamp with a hurricane shade on it, and he accidentally threw it into the crowd, and it, because we were up on the stage, and it dropped down and smashed all over the floor. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I remember it.
Jeez, that was something. Yeah.
Now, we had, you know, you were talking about characters. I had a guy, but I won't say the name again, but Jim was his name. We were setting up, I had a two-day estate auction in Boulder that blow you clear away, and he was carrying stuff out, and he had a toupee. And his arms were clear full. The guys that loaded him were carrying it outside, and he went by a wishing well, and he caught that toupee, and it got over his eyes. And, of course, nobody would help him. All of the boys that were helping just let him wander, and he finally found something to set it on. But probably one of those, everybody saw it, and it was one of the funniest things that I've ever had at an auction.
No one had a camera, huh? That's too bad.
No one had a camera, no.
Jeez, that's something else. Now, that's
not... You had a muscle shirt on, too, and that didn't help any.
Now, that wasn't your relative, Jim, was it?
Yeah, that could have been.
I can picture the whole thing right now. Oh, my God. That's great. Great. Well, Floyd, this is... we're going to be interviewing... Do you remember Greg Willett?
Yes, I remember Greg over at Lyons.
Right, right. He's moved all around the country. I'm going to be talking to him next. And so this is going to be it for us today. And it's been great talking to you, Floyd.
Yeah, I do, too. We had a lot of fun. And
we sure did.
We won't go into some of the fun, but I enjoyed talking to you. And you know, I enjoyed your dad and you both.
Yeah, it was a real pleasure working with you and Carolyn and your family all those many years ago.
You bet, and good fortune to you, Martin.
Thank you. Take care.
You bet.
Now, the great Floyd Edmonds, former owner of Wagon Wheel Auctions in Niwot, Colorado. Great guy. And our next guest I had mentioned I had met on the road going to my new job out there in Colorado in 1977, Greg Willett. And the continuing story of that is I was at a barbecue 6 months later, turned around at a volleyball game, and he was right behind me. And I hadn't talked to him or didn't even know where he lived in Colorado when I met him on the road. Hey, Greg, how you doing?
I'm doing fine, Marty.
You remember all that?
I remember the encounter in the rec area. I was hauling antiques from Maine to my house/shop in Colorado, and we spoke there. I had actually forgotten about us meeting at the party, but that's the party days in the 70s in Colorado were pretty intense. Just kidding.
That's right.
And the antique world out there was a small world. Where I lived in Lyons, I think at the time there was every bit of 8 to 10 shops. And the party, I believe, was head of other antique dealers. Niwot, where Floyd had his auction, you were employed. There was certainly a handful of shops there as well, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right. Now, I remember that that van you had, it was a big Dodge, big size Dodge van, and I remember, you know, a million press backs on the outside of it and packed full. Didn't you put like a, how many miles did you put on that thing going back and forth from Maine?
The yellow Dodge van I traded in with 330,000 miles on it. The silver Dodge van, I gave it to an employee in, it was an 86. I bought it new, and in 2003, I gave it to an employee. It had 630,000 miles on the original engine.
Oh, my goodness.
I slowed down in my old age. I have a diesel Ford van now, and it's from 2003, and it only has 200,000 on it. So I slowed down a little bit. But that's because I've been doing importing in Europe and in Asia, so I don't drive it everywhere. One interesting point is in 74 in Colorado, I had the metal roof rack custom made, and I still have it on the current vehicle today. It has close to 2 million miles on it.
That's almost an antique itself.
Sure is.
So I remember way back then in the 70s, what was hot in Colorado at the time was oak and things like that. Is that primarily what you were doing?
No, actually, I decided to, I've always been a little bit of a contrarian.
Yes,
and,
you have.
I was picking the good pickers in New England and building up loads, and the things that I was buying, I found the competition on the oak was very stiff. So I was buying country. And I thought, in anticipation of our conversation, I thought, what was I selling back then? And I would buy cottage chest of drawers, cottage pine. Deacon's benches were a real big staple. Windsor chairs, baskets, folk art, primitives, checkerboards. The smaller something was, the more I liked it. Wall boxes, knife trays, hooked rugs. And the markets, I can remember the first time I ever went to Colorado with a load that was on a vacation. And I went to Lyons, where there were 10 shops, And then I went to Denver. I saw 12 dealers, and I did not sell a single item to any of them. But the 13th dealer, she's not in business anymore, Nita's Antiques on Broadway in South Denver, purchased my entire load. And that started a long-term business relationship with her.
Now, what did you? How did you get into the antiques initially?
Well, I'm a marine biologist by training, and I was very excited about my goal was to work on the Chesapeake Bay and save it for future generations because I'm addicted to blue crabs. However, in my enthusiasm of being the next Jacques Cousteau and being on the boat and being in the water, I neglected to realize that I would be faced with in the working environment of dealing with bureaucracies and ineptitude. So I worked for the state of Maryland for a very short 6 months. I came home and told my wife at the time that I quit. She thought I was out of my mind, and she said, "What are you going to do?" I said, "We're going to make a full-time business selling antiques," which I'd done as a hobby. We had traveled from suburban Maryland to West Virginia and bought trunks and commodes and did some refinishing and went to flea markets, but I decided to take it to the next level. Took me 4 years to, it was like going to college a second time, to learn the business and to learn the product.
Wow. Normally you wouldn't see a segue between marine biology and the antiques, but unless you were doing dives and shipwrecks and things like that. But interesting.
My interest in science was strong, but I have a genetic background in sales and getting along with people. My dad, his dad, and my sisters were all in sales. And buying antiques is selling yourself to get the person to say yes. Mm-hmm. And selling antiques is selling yourself as well.
I remember how successful you were back in, I remember stopping in Lyons many, many years ago. You had quite a house out there, too, if I remember right.
Yeah, I bought my first house in Colorado. I'd been priced out of the real estate market in Washington, D.C., where I grew up. And I had a basket collection, and I had some redware and some stoneware that I sold. That gave me enough money to buy my first house virtually for cash, which is, turned out, it's not the brightest thing to do. mortgages are a good thing, but no one was going to give a 24-year-old guy with a self-employed antique dealer 1 year experience a mortgage. So I bought this beautiful house in Colorado that was owned commercial, and I had some commercial lots, and the plan was to open a full-time shop. And then I realized that I needed to do more homework. And so basically once a month I drove from West Central Maine to Colorado. I was actually tacking on over 10,000 miles a month. And I would buy in the day and drive a little bit and sell in the morning and buy some more and sell.
Wow.
I don't know if I should tell you this next part, but I didn't have a lot of money back then after I bought the house. But with the banking system the way it was, I had a checking account in Maine, in St. Louis, and in Colorado. And when I ran out of cash in Maine, I just wrote St. Louis checks. And a day and a half later, I was in St. Louis selling to customers and making a bank deposit. At which point in Missouri, I could buy as much as I wanted with the Colorado checks. And a day and a half later, I was in Colorado selling, covering those. I never bounced a check ever in my life.
That was considered almost kiting, right?
Yes. You couldn't do it today because of the instant clearing. When I started, the first time I ever bought a load, I had $200 in an El Camino. And now $200 barely buys you a tank of diesel and a couple meals or a night in a hotel.
Right, right. Now, was your wife with you at the time when you were doing all that, traveling around?
I've had a sorted marital history. My first wife and I were antique buffs, and we were in business together, although she was the school kindergarten teacher in the little town in Colorado, in Lyons, and her first income of mine was the antiques. That lasted a very short period of time. She dumped me for a cowboy.
The old cowboy thing.
I met my second wife when I hauled a load of antiques to California and visited a friend. I knocked on the wrong door, and she answered the door. And I said, "I'm in the wrong place, but would you like to go out to dinner with me tonight?" And she said yes, and she's given me two beautiful sons, and we had a 10-year relationship there.
Wow, you are smooth, man. Boy. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit going back to the day. I remember I was in Colorado for 3 years, and then I moved back to Maine. And then one day I was up in Kennebunk, and there you were. You moved to Maine too, right?
Yes, I did. after the haul and back and forth, I went from Maryland to Maine because I knew that there was a bigger supply of antiques in Maine than there was in West Virginia where I started picking. When I got tired of being the road warrior and I knew that I had a little more knowledge and I also had the customer base, for that first period of time, my profit was based almost solely on geographical differences in price.
Right.
One thing we didn't talk about is what I brought back to Maine with me from Colorado.
Oh, really?
For this 7, 8, 9 year period, the first trip, I realized that it's no good to deadhead, and I brought a van load of Coors beer, which was very it was available in the East Coast, and it was in high demand.
That's right.
I didn't realize that it might not have been legal because of. But I remember pulling into an auction in Rhode Island once, and I opened up the door, and somebody saw the beer, and the auctioneer had to stop the auction until I got done selling beer.
I remember that. I actually brought back some Coors beer when I was visiting back, you know, in Maine from Colorado. And I remember asking why they didn't ship it back, I guess it was east of the Mississippi, and they said it was because of refrigeration purposes.
Yeah, it did. But I sold mine, whether it was unrefrigerated or not. But that was only one or two trips. I soon figured out that there were an awful lot of pie safes, dry sinks, corner cupboards, jelly cupboards, baskets, and quilts in Missouri and Iowa. And for that period of time, I think the picking in Missouri and Iowa was as good as anywhere in the United States. And I went from the van to a van and a U-Haul trailer, and then I got a bigger trailer. And I did some math this morning in anticipation of our conversation. I know that I brought back 25-plus case pieces a trip, 12 trips a year for 8 years. That's getting way over 2,000 pieces of country furniture that I hauled out of the Midwest, Illinois, Missouri, Iowa, Indiana, and sold in Rhode Island, Connecticut, Maine, and Massachusetts.
Wow. So you knew you were doing – this was back – these days are gone now. I mean, this was a whole regional thing is what you were doing.
Absolutely. And it's very interesting about regions. The best furniture in Missouri, northern Missouri and southern Iowa, is in the German Hill Country, which has the same, the Germans were in West Texas. They've got great indigenous furniture there. And then you get into the center of Nova Scotia, the Annapolis River Valley there. It's all German. And same as Pennsylvania Dutch. Those
mm-hmm.
great, those are the great regions of good, fertile land, primarily inhabited by German immigrants, and they carried with them a good skilled craftsmanship heritage, so the country furniture there tends to be good.
Now I know up in Canada, there was like in the Midwest, up north in Canada, there was a lot of really nice painted furniture as well. Did you ever go into Canada at all?
Yes, I did, but my experience in Canada, when I moved back to Maine, more or less, middle 80s, I have to say, my two children are young. I had been working out of West Central Maine. We moved to Kennebunk because of the school districts were better in the south,
mm-hmm.
Southern part of the state, and that's when I started working Canada, and that's also when I stopped picking pickers and started knocking doors exclusively, and but I had connections. I had spoke a little French, and so I worked in Quebec, and Quebec has quite a little culture of pickers and door knockers. So they were all going to New Brunswick and Nova Scotia, where the people live in the old ways, and yet the economy was depressed. The fishing industry was weak, so money talked.
Mm-hmm.
And for many, many years, as a matter of fact, there is not a village, a city, or a town in the province of Nova Scotia that I have not knocked doors in. Not to say that I've knocked every door, but I've completely canvassed that province. And as far as upper Midwest in Canada, I've done very little work. I watched most of the Ontario dealers, when they want stock, they go to Quebec and buy from the Quebec pickers. So when I went to Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, I would pick with a French-Canadian partner. And the product that was worth more money in Ontario, we would sell at auction in Quebec. And then the product that was worth more down in the States, I would take down and sell down there.
Wow. Now, just for a listener that doesn't know the distinction, what is the difference between a door knocker and a picker?
Some would say there is no difference. But a picker all door knockers are pickers. Okay? But all pickers are not door knockers. When I was hauling from Maine to Colorado and back and forth, I was basically buying from door knockers and picking for my customers who had retail shops. Ralston and Lyons, who wanted the machines and the lighting and the jukeboxes, he was one customer. Nita, who bought the primitives, she was another. Pete Tucker, who had the antique shop, who was an old customer like that.
But
all door knockers are pickers. And a door knocker is somebody that will go out in their truck and go door to door looking for antiques. When I would go on a trip, I would never come home until I was out of money or until I was out of space. And you decide where you're going to go, and you start at one end of town or you start at one end of the county, and you methodically canvas. The best pickers go to every door, although some think that they can see through walls and just pick and choose houses. The most successful ones I've known are they knock every door in a town, even a mobile home or a mansion.
I think we talked earlier, and I think that we're going to actually do a segment on door knockers and pickers. So we'll get more into that later. Hopefully you'll be on another session later on. And you gave me a bunch of names to call on that. Thank you about that. So, because that's a really interesting segment. I know the History Channel has a show coming up soon on the American Picker. I think it's called something like that. Now you were in Kenny. I know where you are now. So you're in Kennebunk. So what went on during that time and progressed?
Picking and selling and establishing my footprint. The most fun I had there was when I had a shop at the Wells Union Antique Center on Route 1.
Oh yeah.
And Wells, and my shop was open on Wednesdays and by chance or appointment. And I would pick. I put more emphasis on buying than on selling. And the show dealers would come around on Wednesdays, and if they were always good for 200 to 1,000 or maybe a little more, depending on how the shows had been the weekend before. I got involved with Antiques on 9, which was a big operation.
I know where that is.
10,000 square foot with two other antique dealers. And one was an importer from Holland in Germany. And at this time, picking was getting a little bit tough. Business was still rocking and rolling, and my fresh Canadian partner that I knocked in Nova Scotia went on vacation to Spain and called me on the phone and said, get over here, we're going to make money. he told me he spoke Spanish and that we could get put together a load. The first container we bought in Spain, merchandise plus expenses, cost $65,000, and we sold for $75,000. Took us 3 weeks to put that together. The second container plus expenses cost us $23,000, and we sold for $85,000.
That's more like it.
Yeah, there was a learning curve involved. But we would actually, we did a combination of picking the gypsies in Spain and France, who are the underclass, and they're the ones that get the junk and the used furniture and the doors and windows and wool and stuff like that. But we also knocked doors as well when we couldn't find the pickers. There's experiences there that I could talk about for hours. After things got pretty tough in New England in the early 90s, as you might remember, especially in Maine. There were foreclosure signs everywhere.
Right.
I went through a personal change of life and got a divorce. And about 2 years later, I met the love of my life and moved to Wisconsin. That was 1993 or 4. And I knew nobody out here, so I started knocking doors out here, and have grown and grown. I haven't knocked a door now in 5 years in Wisconsin, although I started buying in China about 4 years ago, and every other trip when I go to China, we go into the villages and go door to door, which is also an experience.
Wow.
In the United States, if you can buy in 1 out of 20 houses, you're doing very good. In China, you get into every single house, and they want you to buy something in every single house. So it's kind of topsy-turvy. And what I buy when I'm in China is the same thing I bought in Spain and France, and primarily what I was buying when I was picking that. When you're a door knocker, you buy everything. But when you're a picker, you can pick and choose. And I've always been, have always leaned towards what the Spanish call cosas rusticas, rustic things. Country primitives. So in China, that's what I buy. It's impossible for a Westerner to come into China and to buy fine porcelains or fine jade. The reproductions are abound, and even the reproductions are high priced.
Yes.
And you can't export anything out of the country of China. It used to be that it was made before 1900, and then when the Olympics came, they prohibit the export of anything made before 1946.
Really?
Although the 1946 rule still allows me to get 100-year-old stuff out because they don't care. And before, when it was 1900s, I could get out 1850 stuff. But there's no way that you're going to be able to get out, legally get out, any fine porcelains or jade or ivory, anything like that. It's against the law.
Just like Egypt and places like that, where there are antiquities.
Exactly.
Wow.
Exactly.
You never did like a container or anything like that, did you?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, I think, let's say, about 22 containers out of China.
Really?
You get everything piled up in one location, and a representative of the government comes and looks at every single piece. And
really?
They put a seal on every piece. That means it's allowed to be exported. And if you have something that you ended up with that's too good or too old, too bad for you, you lose it. It's gone.
Wow.
Boom.
Wow.
It's confiscated.
Something. Wow. So now you're in Wisconsin, and what's the town you're in?
I live in Appleton, Wisconsin, which is in the Fox River Valley, 100 miles north of Milwaukee, 110 miles northwest of Madison, and 30 miles south of Green Bay.
And you have a
Kimberly Clark Paper and Nina Foundry. They make sewer tile covers and toilet paper and things.
Now you have a shop.
Well, I actually do not have a shop. I have a major presence in an antique mall here.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, the day of the single owner shop is pretty much come and gone.
Hasn't it? Seems to be.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when Ed Welch Romaine came by promoting antique malls. And I thought he was crazy. Who would want to buy something from a sales clerk who was opening a case for you?
Sure.
I was wrong there.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I said, well, who wants to buy something on the Internet when you can't touch it? And I got on the Internet in 99, and I've sold almost 14,000 items since then.
On eBay. Wow.
Yes, on eBay. And I have a feedback rating of 9,275 with one negative, and I'm quite proud of that.
Wow.
So I have the antique mall, and the business has morphed a little bit to where it's not only the buying and selling of antiques, but I also do appraisals. I do equitable gifting, mediation, and estate strategy settlements. The boomers are aging, and mom and pop are moving out of their houses or moving on to heaven. So we're doing full-service estate work, and that's probably about a third of my business now. Emptying out the houses so they can be the real estate can be sold.
Wow!
Which, by the way, is a very good way to get the antiques, because many antique dealers don't want to fight their way through emptying out a basement or the overhead of a garage in order to get the good stuff. But
right. So you just have a full service.
Never thought I would be handling that kind of merchandise.
Well, it works. So what's your eBay name in case anyone wants to look for what you're selling?
I sell under the name of Willie51, W-I-L-L-I-E, 51.
Willie51, okay, great.
Yeah, and depending on, I have two listers, and depending on how industrious they are, I have between 10 and 30 items on for sale almost all the time.
Wow, wow. That's amazing. Now, just going back a little bit, what would you say in all your years of, say, picking and door knocking, what was your most exciting find?
Hard to say. I think the best one, which is a real testament to human nature, it was on a house call. It wasn't door knocking.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting the way the customers responded. I received a phone call one day from an ad, and they had comic books to sell. And I said to the gentleman, do you have any 10-cent comics? And he said, I haven't set the price yet. I said, no, 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 sir. I said, I don't mean that. I mean, did they originally sell for 10 cents or 12 cents or what? He says, no, they're 10-cent comics. I see what you mean. They belong to my brother. I said, I don't know a lot about them, but I would be happy to come and look. I went to look, and there were 450 comics, three beer cases full, starting with Batman number 12. I just wished that his brother had been 1 year older, because he would have started reading 1 year sooner. But and I said to the gentleman, I looked at him and I said, what you need to do is to go to the library, get a price guide, get an idea of what these are worth, and then contact an auctioneer on the East Coast and the West Coast to pick the one you like. You have substantial value here. And the son, who was sitting watching daytime TV, unemployed 25-year-old son watching daytime TV, sitting in a lazy boy, said, "That sounds like work. I'm not helping you with that." At which point, the dad said, "What do you get me for them?" I said, "You're making a mistake." I said, "You should do exactly." He says, "What do you pay?" I said, $1 apiece, $500 for all of them. He stuck his hand out and says, "Give me the money." So I bought the comics. I went to the bookstore and bought a comic book, Price Guide. Spent 80 hours grading and pricing the comics. Book price was $60,000 for them. I made 3 phone calls and told 3 different people that I wanted to sell the collection. 2 of the guys were dinks. One of the guys came up and said that I said, "Who did the grading?" And I said, "I did." He says, "Well, you're grading too harshly. These are better than that." So I liked the guy right away. One of my friends stopped by while I was doing the work and asked me what I wanted for the comics. I told him I would trade him the comics for his brand new minivan, which was in the driveway, which was at the time was $18,000. And he said, "No, he couldn't. It would be like the boy coming home. Instead of selling the cow, he'd be coming home with the magic beans, and his wife would kill him." When the deal was done, the gentleman and I came to the price of $25,000.
Wow.
1 week later, the Batman guy flew in from Baltimore. My 2 sons helped me carry the boxes down to Milwaukee, 100 miles away, and we did the deal for $25,000 cash. So my 1 young son said, "Dad, this is a lot like a drug deal, isn't it?" And I said, "How would I know?" That's a nice hit. But what's more interesting is the psychology of the customer.
Yes.
And I was never more thankful for that lazy son, because I told the guy not once but twice the way to handle the deal. And all I did is exactly what I told him to do.
You know, you did the right thing. You know, there's so many times, someone doesn't know this side of it, but there's many times where you're on the other side of it, where you'll buy something and then not be able to sell it for what you have into it. And I've never once had someone come to me and say, "I'll give you some of your money back," you know. Never works way.
if you're an antique dealer, full-time dealer, and you don't sell for a loss, you're not buying enough stuff.
Good point.
The smartest guys in this business know when to dump a loser.
Yes. Yep. Take that money you can get out of it and then put it into something else.
I'll tell you an interesting story, and it involves your dad and then also Olmsted and Hap Moore, who were all New Hampshire auctioneers.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Once every fall, my buddy Gary Chickering, Jim Biondi, and I would go through our shops, and we'd pile up a big, giant load and take it to whoever was working at the center of that auction that month. And we would call it our 20 cents on the dollar day. And we would sit in the back and drink beer and have our Kleenex out. And we would net 20 cents on every dollar invested. And they were all of us. It was all of our tired stock, our mistakes.
Or
for whatever reason we hadn't found a home for. And it was quite cathartic. You felt like a rebirth afterwards.
Mm-hmm. How about that? Yeah, that was probably a very smart thing to do, though.
Fresh money and fresh floor space.
Yeah, there's a saying I've heard a couple of times that dealers live with their mistakes. In other words, you go into a dealer's home, and there are all the mistakes that, you know, he couldn't get rid of, he or she.
I just ran into an estate just 3 weeks ago where that was exactly the case, and the daughters were quite disappointed to find out that the flow glue wasn't in this and that wasn't that. It was interesting, though, in the basement, the lady had a Windsor rocker chair that she had bought from me 10 years before. And I walked down the bottom of the stairs, and I said to the daughter, "I used to own that chair." She says, "How can you tell? You haven't even seen it." I said, "There's a break in the comb of the rocker on the right-hand side." She walked over, and sure enough, it was.
Wow.
There's not that many Windsor chairs out here. And I was really sad for her loss, because Mom was dead, but I lost one of the only buyers in the state that knew what a Windsor chair was.
Now her daughter does. Yeah. Wow. Interesting. Well, Greg, I think we're just about out of time here. It's been great, and I do want to, we will do a segment on pickers and door knockers, because I think that's would make a great segment. So you'll be back.
I'd be glad to give you some information about that. And every door knocker or picker that's willing to talk about it has enough stories to fill up an encyclopedia.
Yeah, I'm sure. Maybe we'll have to make a couple of sessions on that one, a couple of episodes. So great, Greg. Well, thanks so much. I really appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you, Marty. It's nice to have a friendship that lasted all these years.
I know, 33 years it was so far. Wow.
There we go.
All right, Greg.
Well, I look forward to the next 30.
Yes, you bet. All right.
Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. That was Greg Willett from Appleton, Wisconsin. And this is Martin Willis. Hope you enjoyed the show today. Signing off.
Wait, don't go away. I want to talk to you about how you can help us out. We love doing this show. We do it for free. However, we do have some expenses, and you can help us without even realizing you're doing it. And that is, if you're going to purchase something on Amazon, why not go to our website, www.antiqueauctionpodcast.com. Up in the right-hand corner, you'll see there's an Amazon search engine. You can search for your item there, and if you purchase it, we will receive a small fee. That'll help us carry on. Thank you, and I hope you enjoyed today's show.